Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 o'clock. Monday morning, that means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We've got a Blackhawks Express to play back for you. Hawks win yesterday. And we're going to go in detail with the Golden Globes and talk about the winners, the losers, the speeches, all that cool stuff, and how Seth Meyers did and all that great stuff. And we're going to briefly touch upon that in just a couple of minutes here with Colin and Eric. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to review all the new movies. We were off for a couple of Sundays, and so we're going to play a little catch-up, go back and talk about some of the movies that opened a couple of weeks ago, and just touch on those for a little bit. We also got a couple of new movies to review, and we'll talk about the box office as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text on this Monday morning. So let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Colin, let's start with you. What did you think of the Golden Globes?
Okay, I mean, I missed the first half hour, so, but what I saw seemed to just be, I mean, okay. I guess they're running late, so everything was kind of clipping along. Not a lot of banter, not a lot of jokes. It was kind of a laugh-free evening.
they went late really early on. They started. Okay. Yeah, it went late really early on, so they did cut a lot of the banter for sure. Eric, what do you think?
I liked it. I mean, it's always a very breezy show. It tends to go by pretty far. I mean, there's a lot of politics and stuff to wade through. Mostly positive. I know everyone is really on Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
At the moment.
Yeah.
And I have to admit that I was a little brushed back by what she did, only because, not that there wasn't a point to be made, but it made the five directors very uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
At that moment. Yeah. And I thought, well, it's not their fault.
Right.
You know, I was a little brushed back by that. Not that she doesn't have a point, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just like, Guillermo del Toro's just like, well, okay,
yeah, I know. I felt pretty bad about that too. Overall, you know, I thought the show was, you know, it was the Golden Globes, and I thought Meyer's monologue at the beginning was great. I thought he killed it, and so I thought that was great. So overall, it was entertaining, and you know, you always forget, or at least I do, forget just how the host isn't there for long stretches of time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so where's Seth Meyers? Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Every year, whoever hosts the Golden Globes is off stage for about 50 minutes.
Right.
Comes back on, introduces one person, and walks off again for another 25 minutes. So it's, yeah. I mean, you just got the opening monologue, and that's pretty much it out of the gate.
Yeah, and then the thing that I really did like about the Globes tonight is the fact that it's pretty much confirmed that there is no clear front runner whatsoever in the awards race.
Yeah.
It is all over the map, and I don't think anyone who won tonight could be declared a front runner for anything going forward.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I gotta say, right out of the gate, I was happily surprised that Sam Rockwell won.
Yeah, no, I mean, Willem Dafoe has, he started off as the front runner, and then Rockwell has really come on as of late. And I was half expecting them to give it to Plummer just because of the story around that.
Yeah.
But they ended up giving it to Rockwell, and I'm not going to complain.
Yeah. No. I mean, I was just two of my favorite movies of the year, Three Billboards and Lady Bird, and to see both of them like really have such a strong showing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Colin, what do you think of some of the winners?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm not as surprised just because The Florida Project is such a odd little film that not a lot of, didn't get as much traction as Three Billboards. Although I'm surprised at the amount of awards that Three Billboards won, just because it's such a divisive film. It appears lately, you either love it or hate it, at least if you're, on just going by Twitter and online, and all that. Well, I guess a little surprised that the best song didn't go to the song from Coco. I mean, I saw The Greatest Showman, but I don't know. I thought Coco would be a bigger winner there. But yeah, and Shape of Water, I guess I'm a little surprised at how well that did too. But maybe Fox Searchlight just knew how to wine and dine these guys.
Yeah, you know? that might have something to do with it. I mean, it's
consistency.
It's the Golden Globes after all. So
yeah.
Well, it was entertaining, and there were a lot of I thought some nice performances and cool stuff. And I'm going to talk more about it. A little bit later on, we'll cover all the winners and the losers in both movie and TV. So there you go. All right, some surprises too on the TV side as well, and we'll get to that a little bit later on. All right. Now listen, we were off for a couple of weeks here, guys. And now, which movies have we all seen? Now, Colin, you just said you saw The Greatest Showman.
Yes.
Eric, have you seen it?
I have not.
Okay. Jumanji, either of you guys?
Nope.
Not yet.
Okay, I've seen that one. Downsizing, we've all seen. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I, Tonya, we've all seen.
Yeah.
Pitch Perfect 3?
Nope.
I haven't seen that one either. Wow, okay. All the Money in the World?
I apologize. I just realized. I'm looking at... I sent my list and I forgot to include you, and I guess I didn't include you on the email, so I'm going to send that right now. So you have that in front of you. Right. I just saw that. I apologize.
Is All the Money in the World, did you guys see that?
I did.
Okay.
I did not.
Okay, I have not either. And then Molly's Game, we've all seen.
Yes.
And then we've got this week's movies, which would be Hostels, which I know we've all seen.
Mm-hmm.
I have not finished seeing it yet because my screener was defective. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Insidious, The Last Key?
Nope.
No. No?
Okay, I saw that. I did not see Mr. Roosevelt, although I really want to. And then The Post, I think we've all seen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with Colin. Why don't you tell us about The Greatest Showman?
Okay. Well, this is the musical that is based very loosely on the life of P.T. Barnum, who here is played by Hugh Jackman. It starts when he was a boy. He's the scrappy son of a tailor. And how he met the love of his life when he was a kid, played by as an adult by Michelle Williams, who's the wealthy daughter of a socialite, and how he went from being this kind of bookkeeper to starting the first ever circus, which first started out as a museum of oddities from around the world, and then his daughters gave him the idea of having living oddities that people can see, and thus the circus is born. So he puts up signs looking for people who don't look ordinary, and well, they all answer his ad, and his show becomes a big success for the public, although not right away. And many people treat these people as freaks of nature and protest the show. Zac Efron plays a well-respected playwright who helps P.T. Barnum make the show more credible to critics and the socialites and the elite, the rich people whose respect he wants. Rebecca Ferguson plays a singer who becomes Barnum's next big thing and helps elevate his status among other socialites. This is a musical directed by Michelle Gracie, and this is the first feature by a guy who, at least according to his IMDb page, had one music video to his credit. It's certainly competently directed as a musical. Everything's nicely staged. It's well edited. It's well choreographed. It looks good. So this is a movie that is, very handsomely produced and never gets boring to look at. So, but where it comes short is just in terms of establishing who P.T. Barnum was. Now, every reviewer is quick to point out that this is not an accurate representation of P.T. Barnum, and I'm sure that's true. This is a movie that is very soft and very light. It's PG. It is made for family viewing, so a lot of what made P.T. Barnum who he was has been put aside in favor of more commercial filmmaking. to make a more reach a more mass audience. And I'm okay with that side of things. I mean, I've given good reviews to movies like Saving Mr. Banks and The Social Network, knowing that those two movies in particular are also pure BS, but what they're about is very palpable and very rewarding, and there's a lot of weight to them. So the stories they're telling are interesting regardless. That's not the case here. P.T. Barnum is kind of a non-character. He's just a guy who suddenly has an idea out of the blue to have to open a museum of oddities, and then just wants to be a showman, just wants to be a ringmaster, just wants to make the greatest show on earth. But there's no substance behind it. There's nothing that I see propelling him or driving him or making him worthy of either my sympathies or, makes him an interesting anti-hero or just makes him just anything but a tool for the narrative. And every other character around him is basically the same thing. The movie just kind of jumps around from emotion to emotion without really much in the way of narrative drive. The musical numbers are... like I said, they're competently done, but the songs, other than, one song, which is the song that won the award tonight, there's nothing really memorable about them. They all just kind of have the same structure, the same build, starting out really quiet, and then it gets bigger and bigger and louder and reaches a crescendo, and it's the end, and then you're on to the next scene, or the next emotion, or whatever else you're supposed to feel next. While it's a very handsomely produced film, it is ultimately a very empty film with a very sort of shallow non-character at the center. So can't really recommend this one.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Childress, Colin Suter are here. They join me every Monday morning. We're catching up because we were off for a little while. We're catching up on some of the older movies that have been out a couple of weeks. We're going to talk about the new movies, and Eric and I will talk about box office as well. And then later on, I'm going to go through all the winners and losers and open up the phone lines to talk about the Golden Globes, both movies and TV side. All right, we got to take a break here for the news. When we come back, on more movie reviews after the news. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express from a really good game from yesterday. We play that back. And we're going to talk in detail about the Golden Globes, the winners, the losers, the show, how you guys thought about it, and all that cool stuff. Right now, it's time for our Monday morning movie reviews, and we're playing a little catch-up here. We've got some movies that came out a couple of weeks ago that we were off for the holidays, and we're going to play a little catch-up with that. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to review all the new movies, and let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, I'll quickly tell you about Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. It's not as bad as you think it is, because I thought it was just going to be unwatchable. It's essentially like a reboot of the other movie, except instead of being a board game come to life, these four teenagers get sucked into a video game and become the avatars that they have chosen to play with. So, like, the joke is that the big athletic guy turns out to be Kevin Hart in the game. The sexy teenage girl who is obsessed with her phone and selfies and stuff turns into Jack Black, and you get the basic gist, and that's kind of the consistent jokes throughout the entire movie are that these characters are really trapped inside these inappropriate bodies. It's it moves quickly. The special effects are really good. There's a lot of really fun CGI stuff in here. It's got more laughs than I would have thought. It's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination. I still think the first one is 9,000 times better. The original is so much better. But I think and it's really doing well at the box office, man. So
incredibly so.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. So I mean, I didn't hate it. It's not great, and I you know, if you take your kids to see it, it's fine. They'll have a good time. It's nowhere near as good as the first one, though. So that's Jumanji: Welcome to the Jungle. Give it a half-hearted kind of an okay review. All right. Let's see. Let's go to Eric. Why don't you tell us? Remind us about Downsizing.
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Alexander Payne that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival, and it's basically sometime in the future where miniaturization has been perfected, basically, by scientists, and it becomes a tool in modern America as a way to help us, combat everything from overpopulation to, lack of resources and stuff like that. But, only people, who can, has the means to, find themselves miniaturized and enjoy what essentially becomes a really good life, if you can afford it. It only affects, certain percent of the population. Matt Damon plays a guy that thinks that this might be a good move for him and his wife, played by Kristen Wiig. So they go about to make the change and going to hopefully experience all the benefits that they come along with it. We've had some friends that have done it, and it seems like the new hip thing to do on top of it. And after they do it, or I should say after he does it, because she chickens out and leaves him as a small person to live in now in his big giant house, and discover whatever pleasures might be involved. But in sort of a typical kind of science fiction-y kind of way, we discover that is not the greatest solution to all of life's problems. In fact, just because everyone becomes small doesn't mean that there aren't lesser, that there isn't still a class system involved. And while people who have the means can party and whoop it up and enjoy all the excesses of life, that there are still actually miniature slums and, poor people and things like that that have to be dealt with. And Matt Damon becomes involved helping out a woman played by Hong Chau, who, basically sort of kind of guilts and bullies him into helping her out when he screws some things up for her. I kind of veered into, talking about how this, sort of takes on sort of a kind of a traditional kind of science fiction slant. But what is really missing here from the story is the real human element that Alexander Payne, has brought to so many of his great movies. This is the first time in his career that I have actively disliked one of his films. And the entire movie goes off onto really odd tangents, and it seems like each act is its own separate movie, and each act gets progressively worse as the movie goes along. I felt that there's just no rhyme and reason to the progression that this thing takes, and it gets to a point where you just go like, this clearly feels like a first draft with just no winding, no winding road to where it ends up. In really bizarre fashion, and I was really just incredibly disappointed by the end of this movie that didn't seem to have that pain touch. He seemed out of his element with a lot of the special effects. He can't resist doing real easy jokes about the size and things like that, but it just doesn't amount to anything. Matt Damon seems very miscast in the role. Christoph Waltz, don't quite understand what's going on with his character, as he plays kind of like the resident party guy in his complex. And the performance by Hong Chau is one of the most grating things that I saw in any movie last year, and just really just uncomfortable to witness throughout, and really just very off-putting. So this is going to go down when we do our list next week as the most disappointing film I saw in all of 2017.
All right. Colin?
Yeah, I echo pretty much every sentiment there, and I'm going to echo the last review that I, or the last film that I reviewed. At the center of this movie is a big nothing of a main character. Matt Damon bored me to tears in this movie. And that's a big problem, because we got to be with him on this hero's journey for 2.5 hours, almost 2.5 hours. This is a long movie. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes, but it feels really long. Because when that character comes in, she is a life force for this movie, but in a way that I also found kind of irritating. And I know she's kind of supposed to be at first, but I never really warmed up to her either. I never found her terribly engaging. And it was a movie that just frustrated me, because it started out with a neat concept. I actually think the special effects are pretty good here, and I think Alexander Payne had fun with it at first, setting up the process and seeing what everybody had to go through to get through this process. I think there's some fun visuals in here in the first half hour, 45 minutes. But then once it gets into this other storyline, it just becomes this tedious, hero's journey where Matt Damon is the white savior once again. And I don't need that in any movie, particularly not this one that started off with such a fascinating premise. And they could have gone in so many different directions, but it shows this very bland, very rote kind of story idea that just didn't amount to anything. I think we're going to have the same answer when we get to our subcategories next weekend, because this is a huge disappointment from a director who has had a solid track record. I mean, as solid as you can get. This guy was, 5 for 5 or however many movies he made before that, or six? Six solid 3.5 or 4-star efforts, and then this was just a huge dud. I guess it had to happen sometime, but man, is this a misfire. So, yeah, not liking this movie at all.
Wow, I disagree with you guys, man. I really thought it was pretty great. and I see Alexander Payne all over this thing, and I think that the setup is really great, as you were saying, Colin. The way they set the whole thing up, I thought was great, and then it veers off into this other story that I found really fulfilling and actually very moving. And I thought Hong Chau was great. I thought she was hilarious. She did not grate on me at all. I found her charming and hilarious throughout the entire movie. And I thought that it was a nice journey that Matt Damon's character goes on. There's a lot of lessons that he learns in this movie. And I don't necessarily think that he's the white hero. In fact, I think she's the hero, and she teaches him, things that he needs to learn. I thought Christoph Waltz and Udo Kerr were hilarious. I thought they were great and weird. And I was moved by this movie, and I thought it was funny and very creative and wholly original. So I had a completely different reaction to this movie than you guys did, clearly. I also want to mention that if people are going to go see this movie because Jason Sudeikis and Kristen Wiig are in it, you're going to be disappointed, because Kristen Wiig disappears after the first 25 minutes of the movie. Sudeikis barely, he's got like 3 scenes in the entire film. So if you're like, oh, Sudeikis and Kristen Wiig, I love them, they're not in the movie. They're very, very limited. But I thought it was really good. I enjoyed it. And so I don't know why. I mean, everybody I've read, most of the critics and people that I know who have seen this were disappointed with it, but I actually really liked it a lot. So, okay, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter. We were just talking about Downsizing, which I liked and they hated. So we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we got more movies to catch up on from a couple of weeks back. And then we'll review new movies and talk about box office as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Right on. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a jokey time. And we've got a Blackhawks Express to talk about, and then we're going to dive into the Golden Globe winners and losers and speeches and, what were the best moments and all that cool stuff. And we'll open up the phone lines and talk about that, cover both the movie and the TV side. Well, right now we're in the middle of the movie reviews. We're playing catch-up since we were off for the holidays, and a few movies came out. We're going to catch up with some of those and then review all the new movies as well. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Colin.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Colin, tell us about I, Tonya.
Okay. Well, this is the story of Tonya Harding, played by Margot Robbie. And it's basically how she started as an ice skating prodigy as a child, thanks to her very unforgiving and domineering mother, played by the award-winning Allison Janney.
That's right.
Who is a I loved her bird, by the way.
Yeah, that was
fine. The Globes tonight.
Yeah, that was
fine. She's like her mom is a constant presence in Tonya's life, and this is basically how Tonya Harding went in and out of skating as she got older, hooked up with some the wrong men in her life, but then got back into it and became an Olympic level skater. But we all know how the story of how her husband, Jeff Galluli, played by Sebastian Stan, was involved in having Nancy Kerrigan's knees whacked during a competition, which put the two of them in the media spotlight. And Tonya Harding came out looking like, petty and vindictive white trash. And but this movie plays all that out in a way where maybe Harding wasn't to blame at all, and maybe the story has been wrong all these years. So this is told in flashback with interview segments that are kind of reenacted, or sometimes in just flat out invented, in a way that is very reminiscent of movies like Goodfellas and American Hustle and that sort of thing. So a lot of unreliable narrators here and a lot of needle drops of classic rock songs to keep the pace going. And it works. It works really well. This is a movie that really does paint an interesting portrait of somebody who is not who you will think is the likely victim in this story here. There's not a lot of Nancy Kerrigan at all, actually. This is all Tonya Harding's story through her words and the people around her, and basically giving the clearer eye view of who she was that the media was not able to really get across at the time. And the movie directly points the finger at the media for getting a lot of this wrong and points the finger at us, too, for believing it. The performances here are really terrific. Allison Janney is, of course, a big standout here, but Margot Robbie, I think, has a really tricky thing to do where she has to kind of bring this character to life who's been just reviled all these years, decades now, and create a character that sort of embodies what we know about her while also creating something very sympathetic. And her director and co-screenwriter Craig Gillespie has really upped his game as a director and a writer. I think he's a co-writer. I think there's other screenwriters on this. I don't have it in front of me, but this is a guy who has made it's kind of an up and down career, kind of with mostly middle of the road films. But this one, I think he really upped his game as a storyteller and really also has kind of a high wire act of creating a character who we come to kind of loathe. And now we come out of the film with just kind of a new take on everything. I think that makes it for a very fascinating film. I think will probably reward on repeat viewing. I've still only watched it once, but I'm eager to see it again. Just if for no other reason that it's just very entertaining. and a lot of fun to watch. So, yeah, this is very much a highly recommended film. Here, you know, this is a true story movie I could really get behind this season, with a fascinating character at the center of it.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, this is a really good movie. When it premiered at Toronto this year, this is where I saw it. I mean, it didn't have a distributor. It kind of came out of nowhere. Everyone was sort of skeptical of the idea, just like, why are we doing another Tanya Harding movie again? Because, you know, there were, like, TV movies made about her. And, you know, and like everything that Colin said, you know, this is a movie that, you know, is, it's pointing a lot of fingers. And, you know, we just talked about downsizing, which, you know, at its center is, you know, trying to do some sort of commentary on class structure. And here's a movie that really, you know, kind of gets it and understands that, you know, it's not so much the, you know, particularly, you know, the money aspect, and that, you know, people of lower class income, you know, behave like lower class citizens, but the idea that that's the assumption that so many of us, you know, whether it be the media or the public, looks upon them. And, you know, I mean, this is a movie that in many aspects can be, you know, referred to as a comedy. That's where it was in the Golden Globe section tonight. But, you know, it's a film that deals a lot with spousal abuse, you know, really, and does so in an unflinching manner, you know, sometimes for, you know, some mild comic effect, but mostly, you know, every time a punch or a smack or something lands in this movie, it's felt. And, you know, there can be some frustration, you know, having to watch Tanya Harding walk back into the situation, you know, time and time again. But, you know, that's sometimes all there is for people in situations like this. And, you know, but this movie does get incredibly funny at times. I mean, Allison Janney's performance is really built around that, particularly when she feels like she's being cut out of the story at one point. And then, you know, when you get into the quote-unquote incident, there are extraordinarily funny scenes. Every scene involving the guy that plays Sean Eckhart in this movie, who may go down as not just one of the biggest morons on the planet, but really one of the all-time morons in film history. It is astounding to watch him, you know, try to talk his way out of these situations, and what an absolute tool this guy is, and might be the quote unquote mastermind behind all this thing, but there's nothing master or mindful about it, and not even to mention the people that are hired on top of it. Bobby Cannavale has a really funny kind of cameo as a hard copy reporter, as he refers to in the movie, the news organization that news organizations look down upon but now have all become. I thought, you know, a very pointed take, and he's right. And yeah, it is, it's uncomfortable when, you know, someone looks at the camera and, you know, basically calls the viewers out for being a part of what happened to the story. And, you know, I mean, you can draw your own conclusions as to who exactly is telling the truth. I mean, the movie makes no bones about that, like Colin said, there's sort of unreliable narrators in here as well. But, I mean, it's a very entertaining movie, and, Margot Robbie, I've been kind of on the fence on. I haven't quite got into the praise of her in the past. But this one, she absolutely knocks out of the park. This is a revelatory performance from her, and a very entertaining movie that people should see.
Okay, we got to take a break for the news, and we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. That's Eric and Colin, and we're talking about I, Tanya, which is the movie about Tanya Harding. And I'll tell you what I thought of it right after we take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN. Yes, sir. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on a Monday morning. That means my dad will tell a jokey time. And we also have a Blackhawks Express. We're going to dive into the Golden Globes, winners, losers, TV, movies, all of that stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. And the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and we're playing catch up. We were off for the holidays, and a few movies came out. And we want to let you guys know what we thought of them. And before the break, Eric and Colin told you what they thought of I, Tonya. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And now I'll tell you what I think of it. I think it's great. I love this movie, and it's incredibly entertaining from the beginning all the way through. I mean, it just pops with energy. It leaps off the screen. You know, Gillespie directs the hell out of this movie, and he clearly watched a lot of Scorsese. I don't think they make an apology about it. You know what I mean? It's clearly influenced by Scorsese. The soundtrack is fantastic, and all the performances are great. Like you, Eric, I was never really the biggest Margot Robbie fan, and but now I am. Because she's great in this movie. And all of the performances are spot on. And I loved the idea that when they started, when Stephen Rogers started to like interview the real people, you know, to do backgrounds on the, you know, the screenplay, that he was getting completely contradictory stories from everybody. And he decided that's how we'll tell it. You know, we'll just tell it. Did it happen this way? I don't know. He says it did, and she says it didn't. Let's just tell both sides of the story. You guys can figure out whatever, you know. And I thought that was a really fun and interesting way of doing it. And, you know, breaking the fourth wall and looking at the, you know, looking at the camera and stuff. That all, it all worked for me. You know, like stylistically, it worked for me. And all the performances are great. Obviously, Allison Janney is, you know, really great in it. And it's a standout, great supporting performance. But everybody else in the movie is doing. And the guy that I want to mention, which you mentioned, is Paul Walter Hauser. Paul Walter Hauser plays Sean. And I'm telling you, I don't know if I've laughed harder. I mean, he is unbelievably stupid in this movie. And just to the point of ridiculous hilariousness, if that's a thing. Sebastian Stan's really good in it. And, you know, the early part of their, you know, this relationship that Tonya Harding has with Jeff Goolily is sweet, you know, and I didn't expect that to happen. And you're right. I mean, it's an indictment of you know, tabloidism and what we believe and what we perceive, just, you know, and it really is about class as well. Like, she didn't have the kind of money to, you know, to have all the fancy costumes, and, you know, she didn't do her makeup the way that everybody did their makeup. She looked different. She talked different, but she was great on the ice. And that's all that really should matter. But, yeah, and the dynamic between Allison Janney and Margot Robbie, man, there are scenes in this movie between the two of them, or even between the actresses who play her as younger, that are just catch brutal, man. And but I loved it. I think it's one of the best films of the year. So I loved I, Tonya, and I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Okay, Eric, tell us about Molly's Game.
Okay, this is the latest effort from Aaron Sorkin, but his first effort in the director's chair, and tells a true story based on a book by a woman named Molly Bloom, who was at one time competing downhill slope competitor in the Olympics. An injury basically forced her out of that, and she wound up, through a set of circumstances, becoming basically running a high stakes poker game for a guy that she works with, and then as she sort of learns the ropes and understands what the people who are, you know, coming into this game are all about, finds her way, you know, out of it, and basically being able to take control of the situation. Jessica Chastain plays Molly, and the film is kind of a series of flashbacks. In present time, we find out that she has been arrested by the FBI, but only 2 years removed from the last time she actually ran a poker game. So there's this sort of aura of mystery as to precisely why, you know, why now she's being taken to task for these activities that may or may not have been illegal. It seemed like there was a lot more bending the law than there was actually breaking. So she hires a lawyer played by Idris Elba, who is not at first interested in her case, but eventually is as intrigued as the rest of us as to why the law is coming down on her now, above all things. She has written the book in the movie already, and that turns out to be sort of a big clue as to you know, why all these things might be happening to her. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so the movie, you know, tells this really kind of long story of how, you know, this poker game progressed and the different people that came, you know, that were there. I mean, there were movie stars and major business people, and we get to know some of them and how they become involved in this ultimate story. One of them played by Michael Cera, who I originally guessed was probably maybe been Ben Affleck, but turns out, from what I understand, was actually supposed to be Tobey Maguire. But that's actually one of the things that is talked about in the movie, is that she changed names in the book. So that's one of the reasons why there is some discrepancies as to, you know, why the veracity of her story. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Aaron Sorkin's work. I mean, obviously, stuff like Social Network, American President, Few Good Men, Steve Jobs. I've always been a fan of his style of writing. I love his rhythms. I love you know, the you know, some of the intricate narratives that he weaves sometimes. But this one I found a bit disappointing, and not the least of which is sort of the actual center mystery of the whole thing. That we take this, again, this very long sort of journey that, you know, as we're trying to discover exactly what is behind, you know, why this thing has become what it eventually becomes by the end of it. And the ultimate resolution to that just seems like, you know, what is sort of referred to now as sort of a big nothing burger. And so by the end of it, I was kind of like, really? That's really all there is to this story. So I found that a little a bit disappointing. I haven't seen it a second time. I'm just kind of give this movie a second chance. Kevin Costner also stars in the movie as her father, and there's a really awkward scene towards the end of the movie where he sort of reappears in her life at an ice skating rink. And when I saw the movie, and I was watching this movie, my first thought watching this entire scene, because there's been this long absence from his character, and I wasn't sure if at this point in the movie he was actually alive or dead, and that maybe this was a writer's technique to reinsert him into the movie and for to have this sort of this closure with this character on a park bench when, you know, it could be a fantasy. And the fact that it turns out to not be a fantasy, I found really odd and kind of off-putting. And I thought that kind of, again, contradicts what is sort of the ultimate point of the story that she herself is trying to tell. I thought that it contradicted with this one kind of big revelation that she has of why she tells the story the way she does, and to have this father figure, not father figure, but her actual father character be there to sort to diagnose that he's a psychiatrist, to diagnose her in a way and to grant this moment of forgiveness, I thought was just really kind of off. So it's not, the movie's not completely without merit. I mean, there is flashes of the Sorkin that I like in this movie, but I think as a director, I think he backed the wrong horse, taking down this material. I think that I would have rather liked to have seen Craig Gillespie, frankly, you know, tell the story in the manner that he told I, Tonya. I thought it would be a lot more interesting. I think that he doesn't quite know when to cut away from certain things in this movie. And as Colin mentioned earlier, downsizing is almost 2.5 hours. This movie just about is 2.5 hours, and I think it a little bit tighter would have been warranted here. So I can't quite recommend Molly's Game.
Okay. Hang on, guys, okay? We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin thought of Molly's Game, and I'll tell you what I thought of Molly's Game. We are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and the new ones are coming up. We got new movies to review. We'll tell you all about that. Colin up right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning movie reviews. We're playing catch-up. We were off for the holidays, just telling you about what we thought of some of the movies that came out while we were off. And then we got some new movies to talk about as well. And then Eric and I will talk about box office. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin, what did you think of Molly's Game?
I liked it a little bit more. And I, like Eric, I'm a fan of Sorkin's writing, although, I mean, I never watched West Wing, or I never actually watched any of his TV work, but his movies I've mostly been a big fan of. And I think I just, every once in a while, it's just nice to see a movie that has a real screenwriter's touch to it, where, it's really the screenwriter's voice coming through, and I think that's kind of becoming a bit of a lost part of the art form lately. When we're so leaning heavily so much on improvisation more than ever now, it's kind of nice when you're seeing a movie that is really a writer's movie, and I enjoy that. I'm okay with the stylization of it, and I especially like seeing great actors pulling it off as well as Jessica Chastain and Idris Elba do here in this film. And that's primarily why I like the film. It's certainly flawed. It's certainly, I agree with Eric that the last scene at the end with Costner just kind of is a little strange. And even though Costner is acting his heart out in it and doing very well, the scene itself is just kind of, awkwardly put in there. I'm a little more forgiving of it in that respect, just because it kind of took me on this journey that I'd never, the story that I'd never heard of much. I mean, and so there's a little bit more of a freshness to it that, that I think is fun to watch. Whereas that's kind of what separates it from I, Tonya, where we're kind of bringing baggage into I, Tonya and having, turning our perceptions of it. This one, I'm just like, I don't know this story, but it's fascinating. And it's kind of the same, in a way, it's a lot of the same kind of characters, the same kind of story. And especially, it's especially reminiscent of The Social Network. You got Idris Elba basically as the Greek chorus here, which is what's her name, Rashid, was in Social Network. And it's same kind of back and forth structure, flashback and flash forward, that works here as well. And a lot of the same themes too. You just don't get Fincher's, immaculate framing and, Trent Reznor's score and, propelling it forward. But I think Sorkin gives it his best shot for a first film. There's definitely room for improvement, but there's also a lot of solid footing here for him to keep going as a director. So I'm giving it a pass and a recommendation. It's not perfect, it's not great, but if you like Sorkin, I think this is good. This is very good Sorkin.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was good, and it's a little too long. One too many. Like what you were saying, Eric. He doesn't know when to cut away a lot. Some of the scenes go on too long, and his timing is a little bit off. But I think Chastain is terrific. I think Idris Elba is great. I mean, Costner's really good in it too. And I thought it was a really fun movie to watch. And again, you know, like as you were saying, Colin, this is a story that I didn't know anything about this, and I thought it was really well executed, and I thought the writing was strong. He could have used a little bit more editing, but overall, I think it's an entertaining movie. I think it's one that moves pretty well, and I think the main performances are all pretty terrific. And so yeah, I liked it. I'm recommending Molly's Game. All right. Colin, can you quickly tell us about All the Money in the World?
Sure. This is another movie based on a true story about a kidnapping of John Paul Getty III, played by Charlie Plummer, who's no relation to Christopher Plummer. But anyway, he was the grandson of John Paul Getty, one of the richest men in the world, or maybe the richest man in the world at that time, who is played by Christopher Plummer. Michelle Williams plays the wife of the middle Gettys, the mother of the person who's been kidnapped, and has to try to convince her father or father-in-law, Christopher Plummer, to pay up some kind of ransom to get his grandson back. But this guy stays tight with his money and refuses to budge, even for family. So this is about as cold and ruthless a character as you could possibly meet. Mark Wahlberg plays Getty's security guy who becomes kind of an ally with Michelle Williams in trying to convince Getty to pay this ransom. So this is directed by Ridley Scott, and it's a very solid thriller about, you know, this guy who was just could not let go of his money for anything. And Christopher Plummer, you know, there's a whole big story behind this, of course, and we all know it, is really a great choice / replacement to do this part because there is no budging here. I mean, this is an uncompromising role where he just has to be the worst human being you can imagine. And I think Ridley Scott does a great job of with all the negotiation stuff and every scene with Plummer. That's where your eyes are drawn for many reasons, of course. I think the movie, when it goes to plays the other side with the kidnapping, it's not quite as successful. There's an arc that happens on the kidnapping side of it that I didn't quite believe, although I meant to believe it because it's based on a true story. So I'm guessing this is how it really happened. The movie doesn't do as quite a good job as of relaying that part of the story and making it believable. But all the stuff on the other side, and I got to say, like when I first saw this movie, it was screened, in mid-December, and just there's part of me that's, you know, watching every Christopher Plummer scene going, wow, this was filmed 2 weeks ago. That's insane. But it shows no sign of strain at all. It's you'd never know, except for maybe, one scene there where it's a little strange. You could tell something was a little off. Other than that, like this is a movie that is, you know, solid enough. Certainly for recommendation. It's a good thriller. It's nothing particularly, you know, deep about it, but it's very well acted. Ridley Scott did a great job of, you know, pulling off an impossible feat of replacing an actor at the last minute, and I think it's the right choice for the actor anyway. Better choice as an actor. So I'm recommending this movie.
All right, good. By the way, he wanted Christopher Plummer in the first place.
Yeah, no, I know that. Yeah, and I'm glad because I think Spacey, I don't know, maybe he was very good in the movie, but he would have been acting, through layers of makeup, layers of old man makeup. It's always better just to get the real thing. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. So that's All the Money in the World. Now that brings us up to date. Let me quickly review Insidious, The Last Key. This is the fourth Insidious film, and it stars Lin Shaye as a parapsychologist who goes into haunted places and studies them and exercises them. This time she's being called to check out a house that is that is haunted, but it also happens to be her childhood family home. That's the setup. Lots of jump scares in this. I mean, you guys know the Insidious world. This one, but though not directed by James Wan, one of the guy who directed this directed one of the Paranormal Activity movies. This is your standard PG-13 haunted house movie. Lots of jump scares and weird characters. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Lin Shaye, and I think she's great. I will always love her for Kingpin forever. This is as far removed from Kingpin as you can get. But I mean, this is your standard stuff. You know, if you've seen any of the Insidious movies or like the Conjuring world or whatever these movies are, very similar. It goes down the same road. I wasn't crazy about it. It didn't really do much for me, but if, you know, I mean, apparently it did really well at the box office, which we'll talk about. And the audience I saw it with seemed to enjoy it, and were kind of scared by it. But it's your standard, whatever you know. It's Insidious 4, so there it is. So there's that. All right, let's see. Eric, tell us about Hostiles.
Okay, this is a movie set very close to the turn of the 20th century in the sort of the early 1890s. And Christian Bale plays an army officer who most, you know, at least the current part of his career is basically dedicated to hunting down hostile Indian aggressors who have taken up arms against American soldiers and caused some havoc and stuff. And it's led him to have very, very specific views about the American Indian. But as the movie opens, we also meet a woman played by Rosamund Pike, and we see her entire family, and I mean her entire family, slaughtered by a group of outlaw Indians in a such a brutal fashion that it really kind of casts this looming cloud over the rest of the movie because it's so brutal. If we fast forward to Christian Bale's character, who is tasked by his superior officer to escort an Indian family across the way to their basically for this the patriarch of the family, played by Wes Studi, to basically to their homeland, the burial plots where they'll be buried, because he is dying. And he, Wes Studi's character, has been an outlaw and has done some really horrific things in his time. And so obviously there is pushback on him being the guy to escort him and basically to be his protector. Along the way, they cross paths with the Rosamund Pike character, and she ends up joining them. And the movie becomes this, you know, this long sort of classical Western, you know, tale of this long journey where, you know, more violent encounters will be had, and other characters with shady past and presence will be met, including Ben Foster. I think you kind of know exactly what side he's going to be on. And then the characters possibly coming to understanding with themselves and understanding that there are gray areas to everyone's hatred and the reasons why they have done things, really horrible things in the past. So this is another movie that I saw that premiered at Toronto.
Okay, Eric, hang on, okay?
Oh, sure.
All right, we got to take a break here for the news, and we'll come back and we'll find out what Eric thought of Hostiles, and I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. We got a break here for the news. We'll come back more movie reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's a Monday morning, and we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. Before the news, Eric told us about Hostiles, and now he's going to give us his review. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, tell us what you thought.
Yeah, so this is, describing the movie, this is kind of a, an old school type of Western trope that I have a soft spot for, a journey across the plain with characters that are going to get involved in violent skirmishes and shootouts and things along the way. There's a sucker spot in my heart for movies like this. This one in particular, it's beautifully shot. The film was directed by Scott Cooper, whose career, I mean, I know he's received praise in the past. The only movie of his that I really, and I don't want to say really liked, but liked enough to recommend was his last film, which was Black Mass, which is the Johnny Depp, Whitey Bulger story. I wasn't crazy about Crazy Heart, which won Jeff Bridges the Oscar. I thought Out of the Furnace was problematic, which also starred Christian Bale. And I think this one, you know, it works when it's hitting that soft spot that I have. You know, this sort of the long journey, the shootouts, the sort of the characters that, you know, they're very, you know, have a lot of shades of gray and are, you know, you're not quite sure what side they entirely fall on. I don't know if the, you know, potential racist growing, you know, conscious throughout the movie is works in the way that I think it hopes it does. I mean, I think Christopher Bale's performance is very good in the film, but I felt that there wasn't enough of the Wes Studi character to really sort of forge that kind of dynamic that I think is kind of instrumental to the story. You know, the Rosamund Pike character, you know, is, you know, kind of typical, grows into a, you know, a strong woman, and a woman that's going to, you know, is got vengeance on her mind as well. But, you know, I didn't quite entirely get into that aspect of the story. So I'm kind of, it's kind of a mixed bag for me. There, you know, things about this movie that I liked, some of the performances, other things I think it kind of shortchanges itself. It, like I said, that opening scene is so brutal and so over the top that, you know, it kind of sets the stage that, you know, anything could happen in this movie. And then when anything doesn't really happen for long stretches, it kind of starts to become a little bit tedious. And then things pick up again, and then it gets a little more tedious again. And by the end of it, you know, it has this shot that I think is hopes Cooper is kind of hoping is going to be this kind of this iconic final moment. You know, this pullback shot that I think he thinks says more than it actually does. By the end of it, I was just kind of like, I'm kind of done with this journey, and I'm glad it's over.
I thought it was terrific. I really did, and I think Christian Bale is really great in this movie. I think it's a terrific performance. And yeah, it's violent. I mean, that opening scene is unbelievable, but it didn't bother me. And I thought it was beautifully shot. And I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's clear to me that Scott Cooper has seen The Searchers a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of The Searchers in this movie. In fact, I mean, one of the most iconic shots, opening and closing shots in film history is repeated in this movie a couple times.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, he makes no qualms about it. But I think it's a terrific movie. I think it's well acted, and it's exciting, and it's interesting. And it's a good Western. It's a really, really solid Western. And it's for adults, obviously. It's very violent. But I think it pays off. And I think it's a very, very good film. So that's Hostiles. All right. Colin,
mm-hmm.
Tell us about The Post.
All right. Well, this is Steven Spielberg's latest. And it tells the true story of how the New York Times and the Washington Post and you know, broke the story of the Pentagon Papers, which were documents that were basically exposed how the war in Vietnam was orchestrated and how the Nixon administration did everything they could to keep it going. And these were documents that were not to be leaked out of the White House, but well, they were. Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley, who is the chief editor at the Washington Post at the time. And Meryl Streep plays Kay Graham, the chief publisher, who also had close ties to Robert McNamara, who's played by Bruce Greenwood. So she's kind of caught in the middle here. The movie starts, you know, with how the Washington Post eventually got involved with all this and took things, you know, step further and at great personal and professional risk. And the movie does a really great job of presenting, you know, just what journalists are and were up against at that time, with, you know, with readership and, you know, and the stock, you know, the stock price of, you know, the value of the newspaper. in regards to its content and, you know, what it felt it could and could not print. And the movie does play like a thriller of sorts in that regard, where every decision that is made, you get a clear sense of the consequence that could transpire if these journalists and editors and publishers go through with what they think is the right thing. And so they have a lot of gray area to wrestle with. And that is clearly felt in this film. Like I said, this is by Steven Spielberg, but this is like his least Spielbergian film in a long time. It's not visually showy in any way. It is very much, it feels a lot more like an Alan J. Pakula film instead, more than a Spielberg film. And I, of course, mean that as a great compliment. Hanks and Streep, it's amazing to think that they have not worked together before, but they are doing, you know, some great work here, especially their scenes together. And, you know, this is a movie that was made very quickly and very recently. It was made, I heard it was shot back in June, and now we have it here. And it doesn't feel rushed. It feels very thoughtful and feels very, definitely in the moment. If there's any criticism I have of the movie, it's sometimes, especially in the last act, it likes to underscore a little too often just how in the moment it is, by just kind of telling us outright, see how relevant this is to today. But other than that, I think this is a really wonderful film about journalism then and now, and with a great cast at the center of it, and with a story that really, like I said, it feels more like, it feels more and more like a thriller as it goes on, and the payoff is pretty huge. So definitely I recommend this one.
All right, Eric.
Yeah, well, it's Spielberg. So clearly I'm going to find something to like about this movie. And yeah, I think this is a very, very solid effort from Spielberg. And I wanted to accentuate a few of the points that that Colin had made. He said that it's not as visually showy as some of his other movies. And that's true to an extent. I mean, there actually, when you watch the movie, there are certain shots and whatnot that are very, precise and very calculated. But in the way that Colin was describing it as kind of like an Alan J. Pakula film, Spielberg, especially, the longer his career has gone on, sometimes we take for granted just how good he is with actors. And, you have Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, in some respects, two of the most popular actors, ever, basically. And he is so wonderful in that the first scene together, he just lets them go. He just leaves the camera there. He moves it just a little bit, but it's a one-shot moment, just letting these two actors in their very first scene together on screen just do this one take. And it's wonderful to watch. Even if, some of the talk is setting up things that are going on in the movie, but it's just you just watch the actors just playing off each other, and it's just kind of masterful to watch. Also, props to him that the first time he has Bob Odenkirk and David Cross in the film, they're together in the same scene. Just little details like that are just fun.
Yeah.
and then there are things in the movie like, Kyle mentions, how this movie, plays like a thriller, and it does to an extent. But, I think that sometimes the movie does feel like it could have used maybe one more go in the rewrite session. The script was, again, it was a very in-the-moment thing, and Spielberg obviously recognized that this was a film that he wanted to make and get out now while, the press is basically under siege in this country. The decision to actually use Richard Nixon's tapes in the movie.
I think that's genius, by the way.
Yeah.
I think it's genius.
It's an absolutely brilliant construct to use him, basically become his own supporting character
in
the movie.
Nixon, to hear his words
and to just basically see him through the, you know, the window of the White House in the Oval Office. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it also leads to, I think, what might be my favorite final moment of the entire year. At least, certainly one of them, that basically sets this thing up as what essentially is a historical prequel, in a way. Again, you know, he's got an impeccable cast in this movie. It's so well cast. I was a little disappointed that, you know, when you hear you got Sarah Paulson and Carrie Coon in the movie, that I kind of wish that they had bigger roles. But at the same time, Spielberg is smart enough to know that he has these wonderful actresses in there. He's at the very least going to give them their moment. So Sarah Paulson has a big speech in the back half of the movie. Carrie Coon gets, you know, is present throughout the movie, but then gets sort of like the big announcement at the end of the movie. And I think Meryl Streep has not been this good since Adaptation 15 years ago. I think this is easily her best work in that time. And she's been incredibly busy and even won Oscars in that time. But I don't think she's had a role this good in quite some time, and she's terrific. Hanks, please. I mean, he's just always watchable and very good here. It's kind of a little more a verbose version of Jason Robards in All the President's Men, the way he was played, Ben Bradley was played in that movie. But, you know, it's Hanks, and he's just always watchable. I think that maybe, a couple more months, another little draft might have sharpened this. I mean, I could have watched this movie for another hour. I'm just kind of a sucker for movies about journalistic integrity and stuff and the way journalists do their work. But it's an incredibly entertaining film.
Yeah, I think it's Spielberg's best movie in 15 years, man. It's my favorite of his movies since Minority Report. And, this is an incredibly entertaining film. Like, from beginning to end, it moves, and it's under 2 hours. And it tells a great story. It's very timely, obviously. An incredible cast. I want to mention Bob Odenkirk. I think Bob Odenkirk, he's got one of the key supporting performances in the movie, and I just think he's really great in it. Everybody is good in the film. I mean, Meryl Streep, you're right, it's like the best role Meryl Streep has had in a long, long time, and Hanks is great. He plays it a little bit differently than Robards did in All the President's Men, and I'm sure he was aware of that. So I just think this movie crackles and just moves, and it plays like a thriller, and it works, and it's a big, crazy cast, and everybody has moments in it, and everybody's really good. Another great performance and a good year for Tracy Letts, my God. And Bradley Whitford, Bruce Greenwood really gets to shine in this movie. I do agree with you that Sarah Paulson, I wasn't thrilled about Sarah Paulson just playing the quote-unquote wife in the movie, but she is given some nice moments as well. I think this is Spielberg firing on all cylinders, and I just think it's a really terrific movie that works from beginning to end, and of course, very timely for what's happening right now. So I thought The Post was great. I think it's really a terrific movie. All right, well, next week we've got, what do we got next week? We've got the Commuter.
The Commuter.
Yeah. We got a little movie called Phantom Thread.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just this little thing.
Yeah.
And there's one more, right?
Paddington 2.
Oh, boy.
Okay. And Proud Mary.
Proud
I know you're
Mary.
Very excited about
yeah,
that.
Okay, boy. All right, well, that's it. And Colin, thanks, buddy, and we'll talk to you next week. And remember, next week, you guys are coming down live in studio, and we're going to do our best of and worst of and take apart 2017.
That's right.
Sounds always good. A pleasure. Always a pleasure. All right, Colin, thanks, man.
Alrighty.
All right, there you go. Eric, you hold on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Eric Childress, we're going to take a break. We got weather, we got traffic, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN.
Silent movie evening.
Yeah. Flickers of light. Well, welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran with your morning drive starting at 6. It is Monday. That means my dad is going to call in and tell a jokey time. We've got a very exciting Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's game. And we just gave you all the new movie reviews and the Monday morning movie reviews. And remember, next week, live in studio, Colin and Eric will be in here, and we're going to do our big summation with the best of 2017, the worst of 2017, and all the subcategories. So we're going to have a good time with that, as we do every year. Eric writes a piece about the box office, and we talk about it every week as well. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go down the list here. Number one, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. $36 million, $244 million so far. That is a hit.
Oh, it's an incredible hit.
Yeah.
And here, this is the part that'll blow your mind. And even, I think I knew this in the back of my head, but it's still kind of fascinating to me. Because you think about all the studios, and we've had a lot of movies that have, you know, grossed over $300 million, you know, in our time.
Yeah.
You know, more recently even. You know, Sony's only had 5 movies in their history gross $300 million.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And can you guess what they are?
$300 million?
Yeah.
So, no, I can't.
4 of them are Spider-Man movies.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Okay, and the other one is Skyfall.
Skyfall.
So it's Spider-Man and James Bond, and now Jumanji is going to get there.
Wow.
Jumanji is ahead of the pace of Skyfall right now. So this is, an enormous hit for them.
Wow. All right. And it's really something about Dwayne Johnson, man.
Yeah, and I think that this movie, I had said that I thought this movie was going to have, like, sort of Night at the Museum, like, appeal.
Yeah.
Kids, family adventure. But there's also the nostalgia factor that I think has been overlooked in the same way that, you know, this comes from the same period, only a couple of years removed from a movie like Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the way Jurassic World tapped into a whole new generation, along with, you know, the previous generation who loved that movie,
right,
and got a chance to experience now with their kids or, you know, younger family members and things like that. And I think the same thing is kind of happening with Jumanji.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, I mean, Jumanji is one of those movies. The original is a pretty beloved movie.
I didn't really. I mean, I've always liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't know exactly how far that extended, if people, you know, necessarily remembered it in that sort of fashion before. But, you know, I think that it has taken on some significance since the passing of Robin Williams.
Sure, sure, sure.
And, you know, and I think from what I hear, this movie, pays sort of nice,
it does,
you know, tribute to him.
Yeah, it does. It does. All right, number two, Insidious, The Last Key, $29.2 million. That's really solid.
It's a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the last... The third Insidious movie opened in the summer with like $22 million, and you know we tend to see these horror movies. You know, we call them a dump, but clearly there's a strategy to them. A lot of horror movies get released in January, and this one, is one of the top ones. You know, I think it's like in like the last 10, 15 years or something like that. It's like the third best horror opening in January, and the other two we're talking about ahead of it are Cloverfield and Split.
Mm.
If you even, you know, constitute those as horror movies. So, I thought this movie was going to open maybe in the high teens, maybe low 20s.
Yeah.
But a $29 million opening in the wake of everything else that's still out there and people are catching up on, apparently the kids have seen everything, so they just went and saw that.
Yeah, yeah. And Split opened like right around the same time last year, right? Like,
yeah, I think right around. I think it opened while I was at Sundance last year, so like mid-January.
Okay. Number three, Star Wars: The Last Jedi, $23.5 million. Its total in America is at $572.5 million. Is that a disappointment?
No.
Okay.
it's only a disappointment to anyone who thought that. Even someone like me who said I thought that this movie could be, you know, the first billion-dollar movie in the U.S. It's only a disappointment in that respect. It's not a disappointment. I mean, it's going to be like, it was most likely going to pass Titanic. U.S. gross domestic, and I don't know how any movie that passes Titanic can be considered a disappointment.
Yeah.
It's true. Already $1.2 billion worldwide. That's good enough for 13th all time. By the end of next weekend, it'll be in the top 10. So, no, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's not doing Force Awakens numbers, but it's well surpassed Rogue One at this point. So,
okay. Number four, The Greatest Showman, $13.8 million, $75.9 million total.
Yeah, the word of mouth hit. of the season, really. You know, the movie that adults have sort of discovered and have quietly kind of made a hit. I thought it had real potential to do $100 million, you know, even if it was just okay. And that seems to be, from what I hear, is that, you know, this is just okay, but, you know, people are, you know, adults are going to it.
Okay. Number five, Pitch Perfect 3, $10 million, bringing its total up to almost $86 million. How's that compared to the other two?
No, I mean, beating the original, obviously, that was a, you know, a small word of mouth hit that did very well, and then the sequel blew up.
Yeah.
Did three times the amount. So, I mean, this movie is clearly not in that vicinity, but it is going to make $100 million. The budget on it is not nearly as high as, you know, you might think. It's already a hit for Universal, so, yeah, it's not going to do $189 million like Pitch Perfect 3 or Pitch Perfect 2 did,
yeah.
But it's going to make over $100 million, and they'll be more than satisfied with that.
Okay, and that's the last one, too, so.
That's what they say.
Yeah. Six, Ferdinand, $7.7 million, $70 million total.
Yeah, kind of what I was expecting it to do. Yeah, I mean, probably the only ones who are really kind of watching this right now are the people at Disney and whether or not they want to, you know, continue to use the Blue Sky Studios as another you know, animated cash cow. But, you know, clearly this one is not quite up to snuff as we've seen in the past.
All right. Darkest Hour coming in at number eight with $6.3 million. Its total, $28.3 million. As the award season progresses, do you see this movie picking up?
Well, I mean, it's had a very steady you know, stay in the top ten over the last few weeks. Its focus has really expanded this movie well, has seen the interest in it. It's held up a lot better than I thought it would. And, you know, Gary Oldman won the Globe tonight. You know, he might be the front runner for the Oscar. So I think that will continue to fuel it. But the focus has handled this movie very well. And, you know, I think that, you know, right now, even with $28 million, focus is very happy with that. And it's going to keep going.
Okay. Number nine, Coco, $5.5 million, bringing its total up to $192 million. That's okay.
It's okay. It's low-end Pixar, and that seems to be, you know, from the moment it opened, that seemed to be exactly where it was headed. So it's, you know, it's not going to do even like Wall-E or Ratatouille numbers, but it is going to cross $200 million. So
okay, and then number 10, All the Money in the World, $3.5 million, $20 million total.
Yeah, sort of all the publicity in the world couldn't really make this movie a hit, and I'm a little surprised at that. I thought there would be more interest in this movie, or just maybe it was just with the holidays, it wasn't exactly the subject matter that people wanted to see. They wanted to see, you know, Jumanji and Greatest Showman and Star Wars and, you know, all these other movies, and, you know, sort of a kidnapping thriller, even with the, you know, the really interesting backstory that was very front and center over the last, you know, 8 weeks. Wasn't enough to really to bring people into the theater.
Yeah, I thought there would be more people to see it because of the curiosity, because it's such it's such a unique behind the scenes story, so and so unusual that I thought people would just, well, let's go check it out.
And that's what it was. I mean, they eventually got to a point where they just had to sell it in that respect. That was the avenue they had to go to, because, you know, there's not a lot of cry for people rushing out to see Michelle Williams movies. I mean, it's sad as that might seem, that's the case. So they had to sell it on the premise. They had to sell it on the true story. Mark Wahlberg is a supporting character in the movie, so they couldn't really even sell it as a Mark Wahlberg movie.
Right. And also, he's not working on an oil rig.
Right. So. Yeah, exactly. Or solving the Boston Marathon.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, so, which didn't do well either. But yeah, so I think that they had to sell it on the, you know, it was almost like a blessing, a curse, and then a blessing to have this movie in the news so much because of the plumber stuff. But once, you know, people kind of got over that, clearly they just like, I'll wait.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So Jumanji again next week, you think?
No, yeah, very much could be. I mean, I think that Paddington 2 is going to do very well. Paddington was a surprise hit when that came out, and I think that has some real potential next week.
All right, well, next week is our big year-end wrap-up, and so you'll be down here live in studio, and it's going to be fun as it is every year.
Always.
All right, Eric, thanks, buddy. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress, you can movies.com, you can see him, and he does the box office report every week. Okay, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up, and after the news, we'll dive right in to the Golden Globes winners and losers right here on 720 WGN.